afternoon here. How many of you have had a chance to actually read the World Peace Diet? Some of you? Quite a few. Okay, good. So quite a few of you have not. I'd like to, maybe I'll stand up here. Is this better? So I'm going to be doing a little bit of something with the audiovisual in a few minutes with music and with some visuals that we have. But I wanted to, before going into that, talk a little bit about what I think is the most important thing that we can talk about in our society today, which is the great adventure of understanding the ramifications of our food choices. And so essentially, when we look at the predicament that we're in, we see that all of us have been born into a culture that has a fundamental taboo. Is this making too much noise here? Wait a second. It seems to be... All right, is this better, maybe? So the taboo that I'm referring to is the taboo against knowing who you eat. This basic idea that we're not allowed to really look deeply to connect with the fundamental ramifications of our food choices. And one of the things that I've discovered traveling around, Madeline and I, as we travel around, is that the ramifications of our food choices basically have outer and inner dimensions. The outer dimensions are the violence towards the earth, the violence towards our culture. The inner ramifications are the violence towards us and the violence at the spiritual and emotional levels. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is talk a little bit about the fundamental essence of our culture, which is the fact that every day we are killing roughly 75 million animals a day for food. That's the basic bottom line that we can't escape. And we live in a culture where that's not seen as being a big deal. It's seen as being routine, it's something we do relentlessly, and because of that, we are all taught to do that. So what I'd like to do is go ahead and move over to the piano and play a piece of music that's called the Mouse Piece, and that's going to be along with some visuals, and get a sense, a little bit, of the beings that we're talking about here, the animals, the non-human animals that we share this planet with. And this piece of music, the melody came before Madeline and I moved into our rolling home. We lived in Healdsburg, California, up north of here, in a house way out on a dirt road. And when we moved into the house, there were a lot of mice in the house, and they thought it was their house. And so I would sort of catch them sometimes and put them in a jar and take them across the little stream below our house and hope they wouldn't come running right back into the house again. And one day I had a mouse on the piano, and I was looking at her, and I just started playing, and this melody emerged, and it was such a beautiful melody that I wrote it down. I'd like to share it with you now. And to me, it represents this basic truth that all the animals of this planet are beings. They're individual beings with, I think, a yearning to live their lives. They have interests. I think we all know that in our bones. How many of you have, at some point in your life, had a companion animal of some kind? I think most of you have. And so you know that these beings have interests and they have feelings. And I think if we look deeply into any living being, we will see a being that has feelings, and that really I think we're called to look with eyes that see beings when we see beings rather than seeing things when we see beings. And that's the essential heart and soul, I think, of what veganism is all about. It's basically a mentality of radical inclusion, of including all living beings within the sphere of our kindness and compassion. So if we're all set here, I think we are, I will just go to the piano and play this melody. We call it the Mouse Piece. And then while that's playing, there's going to be about a 6-minute long series of images. And they're basically of animals celebrating their lives. It's about a minute and a half in, though. There'll be, I would say, less than a minute showing a little bit of what we humans do to animals routinely. So I hope that you'll keep your eyes open and see it. It could be a lot more graphic than it is. It's not really that bad. But if you, just in a sense, to honor the animals and what they have to go through. And then after that, it's all, again, animals celebrating their lives. So I'm just giving you a little forewarning about that. So here we go. We'll begin. If you can push the little button, the space bar. Pardon me?
Is it before or when you hit your first note?
When I hit the first note, it's probably good. Oh, and maybe, can we turn the lights down for this, I wonder, if that's possible? I think it would be a lot... Uh-oh. Wait a second. Are we ready to go? Yeah, just basically just press the space bar on the computer when that's up, and it should... But if we can turn the lights down, that would be better, I think, too. You ready? Okay.
Thank you. I'm going to try to do this a different way here. I think this works.
You can turn that off. Okay. All right. Can you hear me okay? Thank you. So, as you can see, perhaps I'll get a little bit of a feeling there. The whole underlying dilemma of our culture is that we see beings as things. We have learned basically to reduce beings to things. And I think a couple of things are really important to remember. One is that when we leave here and we go out into the society and we see people eating meat, dairy products, and eggs and so forth, it's very important to remember that no one is doing that out of their own free choice, in the sense that all of us are doing it because we've been forced into it. We're simply following orders. I remember being raised in a typical family in New England back in the 1950s, and we ate the usual meals, lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and I never could question it. I mean, I just thought, this is the only thing. I remember when I was about 7 years old, I said to my mother, "So, Mom, the kind of food we're eating, is this what everybody eats?" And my mother said, "Yeah, everybody eats this." And she came back a few minutes later and she said, "Well, there are vegetarians." And she said it in this way that I knew they lived on another planet. She said, "I've never met one. You probably will never meet one either." You know? They're just sort of hypothetical people. I don't know where they get their protein. They couldn't possibly exist, really. And my mother was absolutely right, in the sense that for me, that was it. I never heard the word again. That was completely gone. I remember going away when I was about 13 to a summer camp in Vermont that was affiliated with this beautiful organic dairy and nestled in the Green Mountains of Vermont, where nothing bad could ever happen to anybody, you know, just really very idyllic place. But I remember at a certain point I was taught to catch a chicken. They said, "Catch a chicken." So I caught a chicken, and I had made my own axe. That was one of the things. And so you're supposed to use your axe to hold the chicken down, and then you cut her head off and put her through the scalding tank. And then we plucked the chickens, we ate the chickens. And I remember as a 13-year-old kid, really I had no problem with that. I mean, it was like I had been indoctrinated in the most intense indoctrination a human being can go through. I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that God made these animals for us to eat. They don't have a soul, they taste good, and if you don't eat them, you will definitely die within 24 hours of a protein deficiency. And that's basically how it is. You know, this indoctrination is so intense, it's very difficult to me it's a miracle, in a sense, that anyone goes vegan, actually. Because in the studies that I've done, I remember when I was in Switzerland at one point, seeing some ducks on a lake, and I realized it was a mother duck and some babies, and I realized what was going on was the mother duck was teaching the little babies what food is. And I realized that is the most powerful teaching in any species that the parents give the offspring, is what is food, what you eat, what you don't eat. So when we learn from our parents what food is, it's such a deep learning. And so it's no wonder that there's sort of this natural something in us that resists changing that. It's almost pre-verbal. And so I think there's this great saying by Krishnamurti. He said at one point, it is not a good idea to be well-adjusted to a sick society. And that basic idea, it's not a good idea to be well-adjusted to a sick society. We all want to be well-adjusted, right? We want to fit in. We want to go along with what everybody's doing in our circle of friends, in our family. We don't want to be different. And yet I think at a certain point we begin to mature spiritually, emotionally, intellectually, psychologically, socially, in some certain way where we begin to realize that it's not a good idea to just go along with this program. But the basic idea I want to emphasize here at the beginning is that, first of all, number one, is that the whole vegan message is really an ancient message. It goes back, I think, thousands of years. It's not some new hippie idea. It really actually has some ancient roots. I'll go into that maybe a little bit more too. Also, that it's essentially an enormously positive message. The whole thing here that I think, if we're working on understanding what veganism is all about, is that it's about a positive, benevolent social transformation that's good for everyone. And then what goes along with that is basically that all of us, at deep levels, have been forced to endure a cultural indoctrination, a programming that has very powerful ramifications on many levels. That's really what, in many ways, the World Peace Diet, in my talk I want to emphasize today, are the ramifications of this. Because the animals themselves that we're eating, for example, do not retaliate. You know, we can do pretty much whatever we want to chickens, pigs, cows, and other animals that are confined and killed for food, and they don't retaliate directly at all. They just take it. They suffer enormously, but they don't retaliate. However, if we look carefully, we will see that inevitably our violence towards them always retaliates. It retaliates as physical diseases of very many different kinds, as psychological diseases of various kinds, as social and cultural diseases, as spiritual disease, as ethical disease. And these diseases actually cause us enormous suffering, but we don't make the connection. We don't see where it's coming from. And I think that's one of the things that now I'm hoping that in our movement we'll begin to articulate and talk about and think about and communicate some of these ideas. Because I think this, when we begin to see how what we sow comes back to us inevitably, relentlessly, absolutely, for sure, then we begin to see that all of us have been forced to endure programming like I did, and I participated in it. Honestly, I remember I was the older brother. I remember my little sister, you know, I was maybe 7 or something, and she was maybe 1 or 2. She was sitting in her high chair. She had food all over her face, and I was feeding her. You know, my mother said, feed your little sister, so I was doing that. And my mother always said, now make sure she eats her protein, because she didn't want to eat her protein, right? That means the little pieces of meat. So I'd put it in her mouth, and she'd spit it out. And I wanted to do a good job, so I said, now, you got to eat your protein. And I'd make it like an airplane, you know, here comes your protein, here it comes. She spit it out every time. So pretty soon I was practically forcing it down her throat to make sure I didn't want her to die of a protein deficiency because of me. So I realized, actually, I mean, now looking back on it, I think, oh my gosh, you know, what I did. But I'm so I have to tell you, I'm very, very happy at a really, I think, very deep level that my little sister is now a vegan. Yeah. And it's so great. And thank you. The World Peace Diet got her. But actually, not only that, her daughter is a vegan, and her grandson is a vegan, and my mother is a vegan too. So we got some kind of 4 generations going now. So that's really good. So it is possible. But, but the point I'm making is that really, when we see people who are involved in eating meat and dairy and so forth, to realize that we've all been injected with that program. It's almost like, remember the movie The Matrix? It's been a long time since I've seen it. I'll have to see it again. But in the beginning, Neo gets captured by these sort of negative forces, and they sort of inject into him, his body, some kind of a bug or something, and then his allies kind of rescue him, and one of the first things they do is they get that out of him. And I think that's the situation. All of us growing up in this culture have been injected with a toxic program, and it's been injected into us basically by our meals. That's the primary way. And it's not just an outer level program. It's a really deep psychological, emotional, kind of an archetypal mythic almost level program that is not in our best interests. And so it's very important for us, I think, to understand the deep structure of what's been going on in our culture for the last 8 or 10,000 years with this whole thing. And basically, for example, just to see the power of food. Anthropologists understand that if you want to understand any culture well and deeply, you look at their food, because food is the most powerful ritual in any culture. It's the primary way that any culture transmits its values and norms and so forth from generation to generation. It's through the meal rituals, because that's our most intimate connection with nature, with animals, with other people, with God, the universe, the whole thing. When people eat together, and what they eat and how they eat, that is basically the underlying assumptions of any culture. So if we are serious as human beings, and I think we all are, about living an authentic life, if I want to live a life of authenticity and meaning, then it's very important for me to understand myself. And if I want to understand myself, I must understand the culture, the program of the culture that I was born into. And if we want to understand that, we have to understand the culture's food program, because that's really the heart and soul of the whole program. And I think we will find, as we do that, that this is the great adventure. This is the greatest adventure of self-discovery, self-transformation, self-liberation, and cultural transformation and cultural liberation that there is, because food is our most powerful connection. And what you're seeing here, actually, and what we see when we see other people, what you're seeing is apples and broccoli talking to you, right? I mean, this is what makes this physical body, so we know this is very powerful. Every culture understands this. But we live in a culture where we don't think about our food. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to go too deep in that. We eat while we're driving the car, while we're having a business meeting, while we're watching TV. It's sort of something we just do, in a lot of ways, very mindlessly. So what we're talking about is bringing mindfulness, bringing awareness and consciousness to the food and the meals, and not only sort of what we're eating, but what it took to get to us, what it actually took. So how many, I'm sure all of you, right, how many of you have actually looked behind the curtain of our culture's food system? I'm sure most of you, if you've come in here, right, how many of you would rather not look behind such a curtain? A few of you, I don't blame you if you don't. How many of you never raise your hands no matter what? Quite a few, I think. But, you know, it's kind of like that, you know, in The Wizard of Oz when he says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. You know, that's really the message we're getting. We're not supposed to look behind that curtain. But if you do, you see, like I said earlier, 75 million animals a day we're killing for food. That means we've had to create a massive industrialized killing machine that is really of epic proportions. It's huge, and it reaches its tentacles into every nook and cranny of our entire planet, all the way to the bottom of the oceans and the deepest trenches, all the way into the heart of the rainforest, into just everywhere. And it reaches its tentacles, unfortunately, into us, every cell of our body, and also consciousness as well. So what I'd like to do, you know, in the short time really that we have here together, is just talk a little bit about the ramifications. I'll talk briefly about some of the outer ramifications, like I said, and then talk about the inner, because I think the inner ramifications are where it really gets amazingly interesting and empowering. Outer ramifications, a lot of you know about these things already, but I'll just say very briefly. Environmentally, for example, what killing 75 million animals a day for food, what does we have to do to our planet? What do we have to do? I mean, we live in an RV now. We've been traveling around North America for 17 years. What we see, this entire continent, basically, has been enslaved to monocropping. You know, monocropping is where you take an area of land and you don't let anything grow there except one species of genetically engineered corn and soybeans. This is not to feed human beings. This is to feed imprisoned pigs, cows, chickens, ducks, and surprisingly, factory farmed fish eat huge amounts of GMO corn and soybeans and alfalfa and wheat and other, but primarily these two crops. And so What that is a whole war against nature, and again, I don't have time to go into it, but the net results of that are a huge amount of pollution, of water. It takes an enormous amount of water to irrigate the crops, and we know, I think, more and more that water is becoming the new oil. I mean, there's really serious problems about overusing water, and basically land pollution, petroleum, all of these things are roughly 20 or 30 to 1. In other words, if someone's eating a standard American diet and someone else is eating a vegan plant-based diet, we're talking about 30 to 1 in terms of water. And these are very conservative estimates. So in other words, you could have 30 vegans or one person eating a standard American diet in terms of how much water they're using and polluting, about 20 to 1 in terms of petroleum and land and so forth. So just to be aware that if we want to just reduce our environmental footprint, the best thing we can do by far is to move toward a plant-based diet. Organic, of course, would be the best. And unprocessed is like the greatest, or minimally processed. So the basic fact is that animals are extremely inefficient at converting grain to so-called food. And so what they do is they convert the huge amounts of grain, which come at an enormous price in terms of environmental devastation, to acidifying animal protein, saturated fat, cholesterol, and huge amounts of sewage. And the sewage is pretty much unregulated. It's thousands of times more sewage than we humans create directly, and it's unregulated, and it's a lot more toxic. One large pig operation, for example, creates more actual pollution, water pollution, and sewage than the entire New York City, and it's unregulated. So we have incredibly serious problems with pollution and of putting out huge amounts of methane and nitrous oxide, which are far more potent than carbon dioxide and causing global warming. We're cutting down right now, for example, about an acre per second of Amazonian rainforest. That is enormously huge implications for that, because we're not just cutting down some trees in a tree farm. These are incredibly intricate ecosystems that took millions of years to evolve, that have huge numbers of species, and we're just burning and cutting them down to grow one thing, corn, basically soybeans, or to graze animals. If the driving force behind the whole thing is people wanting to eat meat, dairy products, and eggs, the same thing is true of oceans. Oceans are being just strip mined of sea life. And there are these new super trawlers. I don't know if you've heard about the super trawlers, but these ships are so big that their nets are so vast and so long, they bring up virtually everything. And they're very high tech. So the thing we have to understand about that is that the demand for fish is almost infinite, because we're not just feeding fish to human beings directly. That's part of it. But much more, scientists have discovered that fish meal is great to feed to animals, if you want to have them give more milk and fatten up. So, for example, in the United States, most people don't realize this, but cows are eating more fish than human beings are. Even though it's funny to think of a cow running across the field, jumping into a stream, trying to catch a fish. You know, that would be absurd, right? But they're eating huge amounts of fish, you know, to fatten them up and make them give more milk. And the same thing is true with all the animals. They're all forced. These are basically animals that would not eat meat, pigs and chickens and so forth. They're eating each other. You know, pigs are eating cows, and cows are eating pigs and chickens, and chicken manure is being fed, and then dogs and cats that are euthanized, roadkill. I mean, it all gets cooked and ground up, and it's called enriching the feed. It's another one of the many euphemisms used in animal agriculture, but the environmental devastation of this is enormous. And I've seen, actually, fish, you know, the thing is, now, because the oceans have been severely depleted, two-thirds of the fish we're eating in the United States are factory-farmed. And factory-farmed fishing is even much worse, in a way, one thing is destroying so there's no fish left. I mean, they're factory-farming tuna fish now. Salmon, of course. These are animals that would swim thousands of miles, up to 50 or even 60 miles an hour, and they're kept in cages their entire lives. I won't even go into the incredible cruelty of that, but the environmental devastation of that, where you have all this feces and antibiotics and chemicals and pesticides just wiping out the lobsters and other animals that are trying to live in the area. So we see this. I've seen actually factory farm fish operations on the onshore ones, where there are these huge swimming pools. And I remember looking and just thinking it's just black water, and then realizing that they're filled with fish. Actually, all these fish in there, and they're just, you know, swimming like this. They can barely move, and the water's black because it's just filled with their feces, and they're just dumping in antibiotics and different kinds of hormones to try to keep the animals alive long enough to kill them in very violent ways. And people are being told by the mass media that somehow fish is a health food, right? When it's far from that, as we all know. So essentially, that's it. I could go on and on here, but environmentally, the devastation is enormous. We're losing about 200,000 species a year to extinction. It's an attack on the genetic diversity of our planet, and the driving force behind that is people eating meat and dairy products and eggs, because that's what's cutting down the rainforest, what's destroying the oceans, what's causing other beings to lose their habitat. And so as we saw these animals, they're celebrating their lives. They want to live their lives, but they can't. With human beings on this planet, we are taking over their land. In fact, biologists say, this is an interesting thing to me, biologists estimate that if you go back 8 to 10,000 years, right before we started the herding of animals, owning animals as property for food, the biomass of human beings, in other words, the physical weight of human beings on the planet, was 1%. And the biomass of all the free-living animals was 99%. Okay, so we were 1%, they were 99%. Today, only a mere 8 or 10,000 years later, the estimate is that the biomass of human beings and the animals that we own as property is now 98% of the biomass, and wild animals are 2%. In other words, they've gone from 99% to 2%. We've basically stolen the land, the habitat from them, and they're going into extinction. And when we crush the viability of oceans and ecosystems, we have to realize we are not doing something very smart for ourselves or for future generations or for any of us. We're all interconnected. The basic teaching in veganism is of the interconnectedness of all life, that we're all in this together and that all life is sacred, and that whatever we would most want for ourselves, to give that to others. This is the basic spiritual teaching of all the religions, whatever we most want for ourselves, to give that to others. And as we begin to live that way, as we begin to understand that, we can transform our planet. So one of the things I want to say right here is just to remind everyone that even though sometimes what I'm saying seems kind of grim, and I think on some level I'm just saying what's happening, but the basic message, I think, really, in all of this, is very positive and uplifting, in the sense that we can turn this thing around. We can transform the situation once we understand why it's happening, and we can bring our behavior into alignment with our values, so that we're actually living the kind of lives. That's what veganism is. It's just doing the best we can to live a life of kindness and compassion. So the outer ramifications to the earth, I've just talked about. I'll talk maybe briefly about the outer ramifications to our culture. Very briefly, you know, we're growing enough food to feed between 12 and 15 billion people. Nobody argues that. We're growing plenty of food to feed everyone if people would just eat the foods directly, the grains and legumes and vegetables and everything we're growing. But most of this, huge amounts of this, is going to animals who are unfortunately just stuck away in these stinking sheds where they never see the light of day, and then they're killed, and then we eat their flesh or we eat their secretions while people are starving. So even though we only have 7 billion people, we have roughly a billion people who are chronically starving because they cannot get enough to eat, because the people on the other side of the bell curve, the wealthiest billion people, we are also actually suffering enormously from diseases that come from converting huge amounts of grain into saturated fat, cholesterol, and acidifying animal protein. And so we have the diseases that come from that, like especially cancer, heart disease, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, diverticulitis, liver disease, kidney disease, diabetes, obesity, osteoporosis. You know, these are the diseases, we all know what they are, that are basically epidemic in our culture and that are all definitively linked to eating diets that are rich in foods that come from animals. So we see that when people move to a plant-based diet, they just get so much healthier naturally. And what we also see is, though, that in the wealthier cultures, it's very relatively easy for us with our high-powered economies to drive up the price of grain on the world markets to feed to our factory farm cows and pigs and chickens and fish to a point where people in the less developed economies absolutely cannot afford it. And so they're driven off their land and they're starving. They estimate it like one child every 2 seconds is starving to death, just dying. So that is the driving engine behind war, conflict, this kind of massive inequality where we have some people eating so high off the hog, literally, that they're just taking the most of the water, the petroleum, the land, the pollution, and eating incredibly wasteful diets while other people are starving. You are not going to have peace on this planet when this is going on. It's time for us to realize and to look with an eye of compassion toward other human beings. Also, to look at the people who have to do the work. Because if you have this massive industrialized killing machine killing 75 million animals every day for food, we have to have people do the work. And again, this is work that brings out the worst in people. So we find that people that work in slaughterhouses and factory farms have the highest rates of worker-related injuries. They have the highest rates of suicide and drug addiction and alcoholism and spousal abuse and child abuse. Because unfortunately, they're doing this work that just... they're just stabbing animals all day or electroshocking them or cutting them up, so they go back into their communities and do terrible things. And it's a disease that psychologists, it's kind of a new disease they've invented, the name for it. It's called perpetrator-induced traumatic stress disorder, because they're just doing this, and so that, you know, it creates these webs of violence that radiate out into the world. And when we begin to understand this, we begin to see that if we really are serious about wanting to have peace on this planet, we have to look at the ramifications of our food choices. Martin Luther King, I think in his great wisdom, said, "Violence anywhere hurts everyone everywhere, because we're all interconnected." And what veganism is about, essentially, is the polar reverse truth of that, which is compassion and kindness anywhere blesses everyone everywhere, because we're all interconnected. Each one of us, every day, we sit down, we eat, we live, we have a choice that we can make, and we can have a life that sends out blessings, or we can take out our wallets and vote, and the system will respond to our votes. Our votes with our dollars, our votes with our words, what we order in a restaurant, what we pay for, what we talk about, and so forth, have massive ramifications. So again, the beauty of the message here, for me, is that we absolutely can transform our culture. We're not some kind of species that is fundamentally flawed. We're always going to have fighting and domination and war and competition and so forth. We're born into a culture essentially with an obsolete food orientation in many ways that we're programmed by this. So I want to talk about that actually right now. I've talked so far about the outer ramifications. The inner ramifications, I think, is where it gets really interesting. And the basic idea essentially is that in order to have a culture where we're killing 75 million animals every day for food, everyone born in that culture has to be injected with a certain mentality to allow that, not just to allow it to happen, but to actually do it. You know, this is happening because we, the people, are voting for this. We're active. We're feeding it to ourselves. We're feeding it to our children. So let's look just briefly at the mentality that's required. And I think this is very important. So number one, it's a mentality of reductionism and commodification of life. We're essentially, as kids growing up here, we're taught to look with eyes. When we see a being, especially certain beings, you know the ones, pigs, cows, and chickens, we do not see a being. We see commodities. We reduce them. We just reduce their status to this, to just being things. We sell them on the Chicago Exchange like bags of cement or something. They're just things. You just sell pork bellies. You know, it's just objects. So we learn not to see a pig as a being who loves her babies and wants to nurture them and care for them, who has intelligence and feelings and a purpose. We steal all of that. We steal her purpose. We steal her time. We steal her babies. We steal her life. We steal everything. She's nothing. We just take everything. So we learn at a very deep level, not just by witnessing adults eating the flesh and secretions of animals, but they make us do it too. Like I did my little sister, you eat this meat. We're forced into it. So we learn to adopt the mentality that goes along with it, and it's essentially a mentality of reductionism, of commodification, of exclusion. The subtext of every meal essentially is that certain beings are just excluded from the sphere of our compassion. We practice this exclusion all the time. We just practice, so we become very good at it. It's also a mentality of disconnectedness. We learn early on to disconnect the reality that's on our plate from the reality that it took to get it onto our plate, and we also learn essentially privilege and elitism, because again, when you think about our meals, what's really going on there at a subtext level, at the deep level, is the message that certain beings are inherently superior, other beings are inherently inferior. And it is the right of the superior beings to dominate and exploit and oppress and use the inferior beings. There's this mentality of entitlement. You know, we're the ones, they're nothing. And we see sociologists saying very strongly that we have a really serious problem in our culture of, as we all know, of economic inequality, of class inequality, of this whole the suffering where some people have so much they don't know what to do with it, and other people just can't hardly get enough to eat. And yet every meal, essentially, when it's meals of meat, dairy products, and eggs, the essential teaching is that this is the way it is. This is what we do. This is how we do things. And so The other main dimension of this that I'd like to emphasize is that it is also, at a very powerful level, besides all these things, it's also a mentality of the repression and domination and exploitation of the feminine principle, of the feminine. Because from the very beginning of animal agriculture, it's been about men dominating female animals. Not just female animals, but specifically female reproductive organs and female reproductive cycles, of inseminating these female animals against their will and maximizing the amount of production they could get, stealing their babies, inseminating them again, stealing their milk, stealing their eggs, stealing everything. And so that has forced our culture, obviously, to repress what I refer to in the World Peace Diet as Sophia. Sophia is the Greek goddess of wisdom. And I think we all know this in our bones, that all of us, whether we're men or women, we have within ourselves what archetypally is referred to as the sacred feminine, which is simply like the yearning of a mother to protect her baby. And it's so powerful. The yearning that we have to protect our earth, to celebrate our lives on this beautiful planet, and to create structures of kindness and of cooperation, and again, that allow us to live our lives creatively and celebrate our lives. And yet when we're forced to eat meat and dairy products and eggs, the essential teaching is just violence towards that essential part of ourselves. Just repress that, push that down. And what we see when that happens, when you have a culture where everyone has had to go through these rituals and had the feminine dimension suppressed so strongly, then we create cultures where we can do what we're doing, in the sense that we can be cutting down the rainforest at an acre per second, and we just let it happen. We don't care, really. And we can be having people starving to death, and we don't care. And we can be destroying the oceans. And we can even be allowing corporations to come invading into the inner landscape of our children's minds and feelings, targeting them as markets for their products, using violence and pornography and all kinds of things. When Sophia is repressed, we allow that to happen. So I think what we're seeing with the vegan movement is a resurrection of Sophia. It's our natural wisdom and compassion that is inherent in us, rising up in opposition, in a sense, to this infliction of violence through the meals that we're all forced to participate in, and that are devastating the ecosystems, that are devastating the cultural landscape, and really concentrating huge amounts of wealth in the hands of very few, while the people, animals, future generations, the ecosystems really suffer enormously from all of this. And so I think to understand, as I was saying, that the ramifications, whatever we sow, we will reap. And there's actually a chapter in the World Peace Diet, or subchapter, that kind of goes into this. I'll mention it maybe right now, because I think it's interesting to see this, that all of the problems that we're talking about in general, that we see, we hear about the different health problems, cultural problems, all of them we are actually inflicting on animals, and then they come boomeranging back. You know, and it's fascinating to see the different physical diseases. Obesity, for example, is a huge epidemic. You just look at the graphs; it's just been going up and up and up and up. And scientists say there's no end in sight. You know, I was reading just the other day, by 2040, you know, 3/4 of the American people will be obese. It's an incredible thing. But what are we doing to animals? You know, they are sold by the pound, so we're sowing the seeds of this. We have our scientists working very hard, developing all kinds of ways of hyper-confinement, of feeding, of breeding, of lighting schedules, all these things to just, for one thing, to fatten them up as fast as possible. And they're now, chickens are getting so fat, so fast, they're now 39 days now, from the time they come out of the egg to the time they're killed, they're fattened up. So we're sowing the seeds on a massive level of obesity on these animals, and we find we have this obesity epidemic. And the same thing with osteoporosis. We see that, you know, in fact, slaughterhouse workers say that dairy cows have such severe osteoporosis that they can break their bones in their bare hands after they slaughter them. You know, how did dairy cows get such severe osteoporosis? Well, the reason they do is because we force them to overproduce milk, and there's a lot of calcium in milk. There's a lot of calcium in eggshells, too. So hens also suffer from severe osteoporosis. In fact, all the animals do, because they're hyper-confined. They can't move. So we're just inflicting osteoporosis on billions of animals in the harshest treatment, and we find we're getting osteoporosis. And we find the same thing with cancers and all the diseases that we're having physical, we're inflicting on animals. This overuse of antibiotics, have you heard about that? I mean, we're just, now it's up to like 80, 90% of the antibiotics being used on animals, and the new strains of bacteria are so powerful now because of this that antibiotics don't even work anymore. Because, you know, this is a direct result. So we see that. We see social, I think, the social dilemmas that we're having. Sociologists talk about the fact, for example, that we have a severe problem with the breakdown of the family. What are we doing to animals for food? They don't have any, they're not allowed to have any families. They would love, they live for families. I mean, their whole thing is relationships. And yet we don't allow that. We destroy their families. Everyone is just given a number, and they become units of production in a heartless economic system. And we find more and more people going, yeah, you know, I feel like a lone unit of production in a heartless economic system. Well, of course, I mean, if we're going to inflict that on these animals, and I think we should really be aware of how these things work, and also to see the ways that some of the industries enrich themselves on this, because I think that's what we have to really awaken to no longer be so gullible, to no longer believe the official stories. You know, for example, there's never been any studies that have proven that eating dairy products gives you strong bones. And yet if you ask the average person, why do you have to have dairy, what'll they say? Calcium. For what? Strong bones. Right. And if you look at any graph of, you know, and then if you actually see, there's never been any study, because there's no study that says that, because it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And yet there are countless studies, actually, many studies that positively link high dairy consumption with weak bones, osteoporosis, broken hips, you know, all this stuff. In fact, it's a direct correlation if you look at the countries with the highest dairy and the countries with the highest osteoporosis. You know, so anyway, the same thing is true with animal protein. The same thing is true with so many things. To question the official stories of our culture, to really begin to do that. And so look at the pharmaceutical industries, for example. Do you know pharmaceutical industries have gotten so wealthy and so powerful that they're beginning to take over? In fact, they've already taken over, I think, the FDA, large parts of the USDA, and other governmental agencies, because they're so wealthy. How do these pharmaceutical industries get so wealthy? They get wealthy by selling a lot of drugs. All right. So there's three main markets. And two of these three main markets are kind of surprising. One of them is pretty obvious. Now, the first surprising one, I think most people don't think of, is there's a huge market, hundreds of billions of dollars in sales to animals, factory farmed animals. They are, you know, literally there's over 10,000 different drugs, hormones, antibiotics, chemicals of various kinds that the drug producers sell that are injected and fed, mixed into the feed and all kinds of things to these poor animals. They have no choice. It's mandatory vaccination for them. So there's this huge market there. Then, number two, the second one is people then eat the flesh of those animals, eat the dairy, the secretions of these animals. They're loaded with drugs, residues. I mean, it's very dangerous to be doing this. Plus, a lot of this, of course, ends up in the water as well. But anyway, so people eat that stuff, and then they get the diseases that are rampant in our culture, right? So this is the second huge market for the pharmaceutical industry, where they get so wealthy and so powerful that they control the media, essentially, and the message that we're getting, the official stories that we're getting. And so people need their medications for cancer, and they need their medications for heart disease and diabetes and diverticulitis and diabetes and osteoporosis and all that stuff. Okay, so that's an obvious one. That's a big market. The third one, again, it's less obvious, but that's the market of the pharmaceutical industries for people that have psychological illness. And think about it. I mean, what's happening? So these are people who need medications for depression and insomnia and pain management, anxiety, all kinds of just problems, mental problems. And what are they eating? They're eating the flesh and secretions of animals that are suffering terribly from depression and insomnia and anxiety and chronic pain and fear and anxiety. So as we sow, we reap. These poor animals in animal agriculture operations, I've visited these places. I mean, they are so harshly treated. Very often they're so confined they can't even move. And many times the pigs literally go literally crazy. They're just banging their heads against the bars. The poor chickens inside these cages are just pecking each other's eyes out. They're all mutilated in a variety of ways. And it's just all about maximizing profit. And it does work well to maximize profit for what I refer to as the military-industrial meat medical pharmaceutical media complex. Now, there's this vast complex. And if we are serious about not being slaves to this system, and to actually creating a world where we have a foundation in place for peace and justice and freedom and health and wellness, sustainability, equality, then the foundation of all of it essentially is the food. Moving to plant-based diets, that I think also it's very helpful if they're organic. I think we need to get away from all this chemical agriculture, and also eating minimally processed foods, foods that are for the most part whole foods, and local I think is really good. I mean, grow your own food. As we begin to change our food, then we'll have the possibility of changing our culture. If we don't do that, I mean, if we don't change our food, if we think we can keep eating meat, dairy products and eggs and have a culture, what's that mean, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute? Oh my God, where'd the time go? I can't believe it. All right, so I'm sorry, I have so much more to say. But basically, I'll wrap it up here. Basically, you know, if we want to have a society of peace and freedom and justice and equality, and still eat ice cream cones and eggnog and hamburgers and cheeseburgers and so forth, then we are completely deluded, obviously. That really the foundation of peace really for our world is for us to give what we would like to have ourselves. And the animals whose welfare we hold in our hands, as Jesus said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. As we give to those who want to be free, let them be free. As we give to those who want to be able to love their children, let them love their children. We will find that happening to ourselves. So imagining our culture, I really encourage all of us to begin to imagine our culture as a plant-based culture, a vegan culture of compassion. When I lived in a Zen monastery in Korea, basically we were meditating from 3 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock at night every day, just essentially working to awaken from the delusion of the conditioning and the programming by quieting the mind and realizing that what we are essentially, all of us, is pure, is consciousness. We're awareness. And when we begin to see that, we begin to realize that we can be free of the cultural programming. And I realized that this monastery in Korea had been living this way for centuries. And I realized that veganism is not a newfangled thing. It's an ancient spiritual practice based on ahimsa, the wisdom of nonviolence, and that as we live our lives in nonviolence, it will come back. The benefits will come back, and we can create a new culture of peace and compassion. So I'm sorry the time went by so fast, everybody, but much love to you all. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. All right. Bless you all. You can make a change. You can do it.